Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. People are stories. Author, teacher, and craftsman Joseph Marshall has written novels, screenplays, essays, short stories, and nonfiction books. He's also a storyteller. He's in South Dakota for the Young Readers Festival this week, an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. He was raised in a traditional Lakota household. His book, In the Footsteps of Crazy Horse, tells the story of a boy and his grandpa as they travel together on a quest to know Crazy Horse. I reached Joseph Marshall III at his home in New Mexico. I want to start by talking about children's literature in general, because one of those, axioms for children's literature is that you have to get the adults out of the way. And, you know, kids have to solve problems on their own. You see this again and again in different fairy tales and stories. And yet, in your book, the grandfather is such an important part of this story, which makes all the sense in the world. You can't have this story without the elder. So did you have to explain that to any editors or justify the role of an adult to be so central to the book?
Well, not really. The editor who approached me 5 years ago first to do this book, he wanted a children's book about Crazy Horse. And, you know, he let me approach it however I wanted to. And for me, it was natural to use the grandfather character, because that's what I experienced in my life as a boy, as a child. My grandparents, not just my grandfather, but my grandmother, and a lot of grandmothers and grandfathers on both sides of the family who told stories. And that's how I grew up. I didn't have television. I didn't have radio. And for a long time, I wasn't idiomatically skilled in English. So all those stories came in Lakota. So that's the reason the grandfather character worked. And when I gave the proposal or the proposed structure to the editor, he was okay with it, because he was aware of how certain mechanisms work in a lot of Native cultures. So he had no issues with that. And that's how, you know, we pass on not just information, but stories that have to do with entertainment or that offer a lesson. But it was a natural mechanism, and it wasn't a problem with him. And I'm using the same mechanism in the sequel to that story. It's the same front characters, but a different backstory.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about Jimmy McLean, because his name is on purpose, the color of his hair and his skin and his eyes, all on purpose. How did you develop that character?
Well, it was easy, because I have a grandson that looks just like that.
Yeah.
He has blue eyes and sandy colored hair. By now, he's now, I think, a freshman or sophomore in high school. Mm. Quite a handsome young lad. But so it was natural in that respect. But then again, I wanted to set the character apart so that there was something about him that was different, and that he would be at a young age sensitive to how different he was. And because, you know, other kids, you know, made fun of him because of his appearance. And that is relatable to more or less what happened to Crazy Horse in all the stories. He had, his skin was lighter. He had dark brown hair. And so those things, those characteristics set him apart, sort of made him the target of ridicule, just like Jimmy McLean. So I wanted to establish that connection, you know, with Jimmy, so that he would have a reference point to sort of assess himself using Crazy Horse as the model.
Take me back to when you first heard those stories of who Crazy Horse was at different times throughout his life. Did you hear those in Lakota from your grandparents?
Yeah, and not just my maternal grandparents, but, you know, there were a lot of relatives. My grandparents had relatives, they had cousins, they had people like that. And there were always occasions when a lot of people got together. And, of course, there were children in the mix. And back in those days, in the late 40s, early 50s, when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, there was still a very strong storytelling going on in the Native community. So it wasn't unusual because we didn't have to compete. There was no competing with video games or television or movies. So we were, a natural audience for them. So they told stories. So that's how I learned about Crazy Horse and about a lot of things, not just him, but a lot of other people and direct ancestors in our family, and, you know, critical cultural information. That's how they were imparted. But that's how I first heard about Crazy Horse. And they were, you know, very simple stories about, you know, how he looked, what he could do, what he learned, that he was a good hunter when he was a young man, a boy. So, you know, but interestingly, as time went on and as I got older, I mean, the stories got more complex. More details were added to his character and the kind of person he was. And eventually, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had a pretty good insight into the kind of a person he was. And it wasn't more than just the glorified warrior. It was him as an individual, as a young man and as a man.
Do you think that was a function of your age, that elders are telling a story that you're ready to hear at a certain age and then telling more as you get older? Or is it more a function of, building the story? Here's a little bit to get you interested. I mean, is it more of a creative choice or a cultural choice, or is it a, age-appropriate choice?
Well, in a way, I think it was probably all of those. I mean, the storyteller usually tailors the story, not changes the story, but tailors the story to an audience. And if the audience is 4 or 5 years old, then it's a different approach. If the listener is 13 or 14 or 15, Then one can impart, more sensitive, more graphic details, and more complex ideas and those kind of things. So, storytelling is a very, it's a learned skill, and not all people are good oral storytellers, and some are, and those who are very good judges of character. They can judge their audience, and so they tailor the story, how they tell a story to that audience.
Is storytelling taught? Is it, how do you become a good storyteller? Do you study it? Do you just listen and it's something that you have, a gift for?
Yeah, I mean, there's no storytelling school.
Right.
You learn it by listening to stories. You learn the stories themselves, and you learn, what the mechanism and the methodology is involved in storytelling by observing and listening to storytellers, and everything from their inflection and their voices to their gestures, and if you yourself want to be a storyteller, then you remember all those things, those details that, how the story was told to you.
When did you know that because you're a storyteller, a teacher and a writer, and those, they intersect well, but they're also different, different skills. When did you know that you wanted to be a storyteller? Or when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I've always liked stories. I've always liked listening to stories. And I really didn't get into storytelling to any extent until I was, in my late teens, when I would, talk to other kids, other people my age, somebody younger. And it wasn't until after that I wondered about writing, because there's obviously a difference between writing and oral storytelling. But I also realized that there were, at a certain age, when I was 18, 19, and 20, that there were no longer as many storytellers around as there used to be when I was a younger child. So it was sort of a dying art, and it still is. I mean, there are storytellers around, but not as many as it once was. So, it was actually reading a book, a novel that I came across that really kind of, put the idea in my head that maybe I could be a writer and tell a story in that form.
Let's talk about the form of In the Footsteps of Crazy Horse, because you have kind of a combination of several different styles, in the sense that you have a journey with this boy and his grandfather. There's a map to sort of help people, you know, follow along to where they're going. And then mm-hmm. it breaks into this, you know, the stories themselves that take you, you know, immediately and very close up to what, you know, who Crazy Horse is. Here he is as a young boy, you know, doing this. Here he is as a young warrior doing this. Here's the final moments of his life. How did you weave those different structures into them? And they're very effective. What were you trying to achieve there?
Well, I was just trying to do for the reader, hoping to do for the reader what the grandfather Niles was doing for Jimmy. Just telling him a story, creating a mood, giving him reference points, those kind of things. So that was the overall approach to the book. While Niles, the grandfather, was, you know, teaching Jimmy, my hope was that the book overall and the mechanism and the structure would teach the reader.
Hmm. I'm wondering if you get feedback from kids. Do kids still write letters? Do they still ask questions of you? Do they send email? Do you have any connection with your younger readers?
Yes. You know, with this book I have. I mean, this is the only, you know, book for young people that I've done. And the sequel will be the second one. But I have gotten feedback from all over the country, as a matter of fact. A couple of schools in the East and one in California. And I've done, you know, Skype sessions with a few classrooms. And they all ask questions on camera and individual questions and so forth. So, yeah, there has been feedback. And you know, most of it has been positive. So that's encouraging for the second book.
So for someone who grew up without competitions from screens for story, you end up being this person who is using screens in an innovative way to keep story alive.
Yes, exactly.
What sort of things are they drawn to in the book? And I read it as an adult, and I'm drawn, you know, to, I'm emotionally so part of this story. You do that so well. Do the kids feel that emotion too?
Yeah, you know, some of the kids, and I don't know, if I can say many or most, but a number of the kids who had questions were, you know, identified or connected to the relationship. Yeah. Of the grandfather to the grandson, either because it existed in their life or because it didn't.
Oh,
and
wow.
They wished that it had. Yeah. And then the other thing that most of them connected with was that Jimmy was being bullied.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that is a real thing, unfortunately. So those were the two main things that kids connected with. And that's really what, you know, that's a way to teach history, because history is a series of stories. It's not a series of names, dates, and places. It's a series of stories. And so if you tell a good story, then you could also, you know, have another kind of lesson that comes behind that.
Yeah. So for some of those kids who maybe don't have that kind of relationship, the book, Grandpa Niles, and you in some way become that relationship to them.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know, for a couple of kids, one came right out and said it, a young girl from California, I think she said, she didn't know her grandparent.
Yeah.
So she didn't have that kind of person in her life that had, as she put it, that had answers. So, you know, that's an important aspect for some kids.
How does that make you feel, that in some ways you gave her, you know, gave her that story through a book, so she has some of those answers now that she maybe didn't even realize she was seeking?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons that, you know, writers write books, at least some of us, is to offer something that somebody can take and say, okay, this is, I like this, it's going to work for me, or it's not going to work for me, but it offers a lesson hopefully, and then it's up to the reader to connect with the lesson and take it or not. And a lot of young people do. I think maybe even more so than adult readers.
Yeah.
In some cases. So that's a good thing.
When do you start realizing that not everybody either knows the story or that there are different, you know, ways of looking? You know, when I'm trying to think of the first time I heard the story of Crazy Horse, and I think it was in an encyclopedia when I, like, stumbled upon it flipping through the C pages or something really disappointing compared to having somebody tell me this remarkable tale. When did you first realize that not everybody shared common stories and that that mattered?
Well, probably when I was in junior high, because I came from a background of having adults in my life, especially elderly adults who were great storytellers. And, you know, for a while I assumed that all Native kids had that. I sort of understood that maybe it didn't happen in the non-Native community with non-Native kids, but I assumed that every Native kid had that in their lives. And then as you know, I slowly began to learn that was not the case. And the reason for it, I figured out over time, was because of the English language. Once more and more kids spoke more and more English, then that opportunity for storytellers began to kind of fade away.
Another thing that I think is really masterful about this book, and it's deceptive because some people read children's books and don't see all the layers of craft that go into it. But this is also a story that's in some ways exciting, but yet it's tragic, and there's violence, and there are complicated issues here. And I think, tell me if I'm wrong, you had an awareness as you wrote that all that was in there and that you were going to have to deal with that in a way that expressed the complexity to kids. And I think you really delivered on that. Was that intentional, or was that you had a realization like, okay, this is a story with some violence and death and loss in it. I can't make it too... It can't be too simple. It can't just be, hey, this is a great story about a hero.
Yeah, we the editor and I and my wife, who was my literary agent, went through that process of saying, do we use this or do we say this or not? And I think we all came to the conclusion that, okay, this is what the landscape is. History was this way. This actually happened. And who are we to judge whether we should deny that to anybody or not? And so we just decided we're going to put it out there and tell it, but in terms that were not offensive or too graphic, but to tell the story. And we, you know, the editor and I went through a kind of a back and forth, not a bad one, just so that we could come away with something constructive. And you know, age sensitive and all those issues. So yeah, we decided early on that.
I don't think this is a book that needs a gatekeeper. I don't think it needs. I mean, I think kids could just check it out of the library, read it, enjoy it, think about it on their own. But what about teachers who want to teach this in class? Do you have advice for them on how to do that?
Well, you know, strangely enough, I've gotten a few questions from teachers, either emails or inquiries. And I guess my, you know, it's if you want to present history, then do it, as I said earlier, as a story. Because it is a story of human interaction, of human foibles, of human virtues. And none of us superhuman, although sometimes some of us will do extraordinary things in a given moment, but that doesn't mean that we're that way all the time. We're all of us ordinary people. And if that's the way they want to present, you know, this story, that would be great.
Joseph Marshall's novel for children, In the Footsteps of Crazy Horse, was named one of the Library of Congress's 52 Great Reads for 2018. The author is set to receive a Distinguished Award in the Humanities at the South Dakota Festival of Books on Friday, September 21st in Brookings. That happens at 7 p.m., and it's followed by an evening with Alice Siebold, author of The Lovely Bones. Meet me at the Festival of Books.